Rainmaker FM.
CopyBlogger FM is brought to you by the all-new StudioPress Sites, a turnkey solution that combines the ease of an all-in-one website builder with the flexible power of WordPress. It's perfect for bloggers, podcasters, and affiliate marketers, as well as those of you who are selling physical products, digital downloads, or membership programs. If you're ready to take your WordPress site to the next level, see for yourself why more than 200,000 website owners trust StudioPress. You can check it out by going to rainmaker.fm/studiopress. That's rainmaker.fm/studiopress. Hello, 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 dear one. Good to see you again. Welcome back to CopyBlogger FM, the content marketing podcast. CopyBlogger FM is about emerging content marketing trends, interesting disasters, and enduring best practices, along with the occasional rant. My name is Sonia Simone. I'm the Chief Content Officer for Rainmaker Digital, and I like to hang out with the folks who do the heavy lifting over on the CopyBlogger blog. You can always get extra links, extra resources, as well as the complete show archive by going to copyblogger.fm. So I was sorry to see that legendary Washington Post copy editor Bill Walsh died recently. Now, this, of course, is not the same Bill Walsh that coaches football. This is a different Bill Walsh, who was a truly amazing language maven, persnickety language person, self-identified language snob, a great copy editor, and a really entertaining and interesting writer about English language, about what errors mean, about, you know, his very opinionated thoughts on correct English versus not so correct English versus abominations. And for whatever reason, it's just a thing that this kind of conversation, conversations around grammar and usage, are always popular with people who are interested in writing and interested in English. So I thought, in honor of Bill Walsh's life ended much too early, I would do an honorary episode about some of my favorite peeves, some of my favorite things that drive me crazy, and some of his favorite, along with a recommendation for a book he wrote. He wrote a couple of books about grammar and usage. The one I've been kind of compulsively reading all weekend is Yes, I Could Care Less, How to Be a Language Snob Without Being a Jerk. So usually when we do this kind of content on CopyBlogger, it mainly consists of errors or, you know, less beautiful ways of writing things that we describe so that you can look smarter when you write. But one of the things I found interesting about Walsh's book is it has a fairly lengthy conversation about this distinction between prescription and description when we're talking about errors in English. So prescription are, you know, the prescriptives are the people who say, these are the rules, this is what you should do, this is the correct way, and this is the incorrect way, you should do it the correct way. And Walsh was, you know, pretty much a prescriptionist, although he was a thoughtful one. The descriptionist is the other side that says language is about how people use it, that the rules come from the way people actually use language, and that it's a bit silly to insist on rules that no one is following. So both of these arguments have their merits. Walsh makes the interesting observation that the descriptionists, who are mostly academics in linguistics, all use the prescriptivist set of conventions to write their essays and their books with. I think the important thing to remember about this whole conversation is there actually isn't a single set of rules that you can learn and memorize, and then you are all done and everything that you write will be correct. English is a particularly vibrant language. It is a mongrel language. Its roots come from both Latin via French and the Germanic languages, but it also is quite a promiscuous little fellow, and it includes words from all kinds of languages, all kinds of traditions, technology, history. English borrows, steals, tweaks, adapts, and evolves words from all over the place. And it's one of the things that makes it an interesting and an exciting language, as well as a singularly frustrating language if you are learning it as your second language. So how do we decide? How do we decide which rules to follow? How do we decide what set of standards to adopt? So I will illustrate this, as I pretty much never do, by talking about a story from the Bible, specifically the story of the Shibboleth. So this is a story in the Old Testament, and the basic gist is this. That word Shibboleth was pronounced in one way by the Ephraimites, and it was pronounced a different way by the Gileadites. And as so often the case in the Old Testament, if you said it the wrong way, somebody killed you. So that word Shibboleth, one of its meanings, I would say its primary meaning, is this idea of a signal, often a linguistic signal, that identifies you as a member of a particular group, a particular tribe. Language is the ultimate signal of unity, what Robert Cialdini calls unity, that sense of oneness. You and I are the same. So the words that we choose and the way that we put them together speak volumes about who we are. Do you say nuclear or do you say nuclear? There's a whole world contained in that one difference of pronunciation. So any kind of conversation that we have about grammar and usage, especially usage, and I'll talk about that distinction in a minute, has to start with a really deep understanding of your audience. Attorneys see and use language very differently from musicians. And gym rats use a completely different vernacular from English teachers. On Copyblogger, we tend to go very strongly toward the more standard side of the equation, the persnickety language person side of the equation, because so many of our readers are writers, and writers tend to be just fascinated by what are the rules, what are the exceptions, what are the little fine points. And so, you know, to honor that audience and to speak to them, that's the kind of language we use. But we also always choose clarity over confusion, and we try not to be so fussy that we become, you know, completely sort of 18th century caricatures of ourselves. So speaking of shibboleths, I'll give you one for free. Here's a shibboleth for word geeks, which is the difference between grammar and usage. So grammar essentially refers to a set of rules. Grammar is about the structure of the language. It's how do you conjugate the verbs? Do adjectives come before or after the noun? You know, how do you form an adverb? How do you form the past tense? It's the actual structures of the language. So I doesn't got no money is a grammatical error, because that's not the way we form the negative in English, and it is not the way that we conjugate the verb to do. Most of what the web refers to as grammar problems are actually usage problems, and usage is a much more fluid, changing, complicated creature. So my head literally exploded is a usage error, since it would not be possible for you to say the sentence, my head literally exploded, if it had, in fact, literally exploded. Nonetheless, you will notice that the site is called Grammarist, not Usagist, and Grammar Girl, not Usage Girl. Grammar is the sort of shorthand that we use to refer to this word, but people who are persnickety at least know the difference, even though you might not use the difference in a headline. If you want to get all of those usage enthusiasts onto your site, leaving comments. So this kind of post is no fun at all if we don't talk about some of our favorite peeves. And here's the place where normally I'm going to put in a lot of gnashing of teeth and rending of my garments and, you know, wails about how people who don't use these things correctly are subhuman. I'm going to skip all of those for the reasons I just mentioned. I think it matters a lot who you're speaking to. However, these are things that I have to confess make my lower left eyelid kind of twitch the same way that Clouseau's boss did in the Pink Panther movies. And young people are saying, I have no idea what that even refers to. But they were very funny. You should look them up. And I will give you three. They're all quite trivial. The first two are spelling issues. A lot. Like, I have a lot of patience with people who use language differently than I do. A lot is two words. A, and then there's a space, and then the second word, L-O-T. It is not one word. It's just not one word. It's two words. Now, most of you are going along with that one, but I'm going to throw a more controversial one at you. Now, I am correct in the sense of if you were my English teacher, you know, if you were any English teacher of the generation of my English teacher, this was an unambiguous error, which is that all right is also two words. All, A-L-L, space, and then the word right. Are you all right is two words. Now that's just freaks people out. All right, kind of mushed together as one word with a single L, has become much more acceptable, much more standard. And a lot of dictionaries now will say that either is okay. It's just my personal persnicketiness. I like the more traditional, more old-fashioned version. To me, that's the correct version. All right is two words. For you, it might not be. And I'm working very hard on my Zen to be okay with that. Again, it really comes down to your audience. So if your audience are writers, I would suggest you go with two words, all right. If your audience are attorneys, those people were all English majors or history majors before they went to law school, I would go with two words, all right. If your audience are normal, regular people, you know, it probably really doesn't matter. Go with whichever one you feel, just works for you. And the final one I'll give you, which just makes me bananas every time I see it, is using over when you mean more than. So this is kind of a fussy little rule. In the olden days, when I was a young person, over was something that you would use for quantities, kind of general quantities. And you would use more than if you could count the items, if they were discrete, countable items. So the grocery store line should not be, and the converse of this is less and fewer. So less is for kind of a general amorphous quantity, and fewer, you use fewer if you can count them. So the grocery store sign should be, the lane should be for 12 items or fewer, and it almost never is. It is in a couple of places, but usually it isn't. So I always fix this. If it's something that can be counted, I switch it from over to more than. So over 642 subscribers, I change to more than 642 subscribers. This, again, is a good distinction if your audience is writers, if your audience is made up of attorneys, things of this nature, people who tend to be a little more, maybe a little more on the old-fashioned side in terms of correct usage versus non-standard usage. However, you know, over and less are becoming more and more common, and it's probably not worth it declaring war over these. So I'll just throw in a couple of Walsh's eye twitchers. One is that literally, and I have to stand with him on this one, using the word literally when you mean figuratively. So I was so embarrassed, I literally died. Well, you just literally did not die. My 11-year-old is really pedantic about this, which is kind of hilarious to see. People use literally to make a kind of a comic overstatement, to create a hyperbole, an exaggeration. And exaggeration is a perfectly great, you know, way to communicate. I have no problem with exaggeration. The issue with literally is you have literally one word that means I'm not exaggerating. This is actually what I mean. So it would be great if we could just keep it for that. It's a useful word, and it loses power when we don't use it correctly. So literally is literally the only word that we don't use to express hyperbole. I think that's kind of exciting. And Walsh's other eye twitcher, which is contained in the topic of his book, is I couldn't care less. So the expression you hear, I would say maybe even more often, if you're just talking about speech, is, you know, what's going on with Brad Pitt's marriage situation? You know what? I could care less. That's just a very common verbal statement. The proper way to say it is, I couldn't care less. That is the more correct way to say it. It is the phrase that makes literal sense, since I could care less kind of doesn't make sense. I will share with you now that I actually could not care less about whether or not you get this right. It does not bother me. It does not make my eye twitch. However, it makes a lot of people's eyes twitch, so I think it's wise to go ahead and use the more standard version, I couldn't care less, when you are writing. And whether or not you remember to say it when you're speaking is up to you. So all of this brings up the question. By the way, it does not beg the question, which is a frequently misused phrase that doesn't mean raise the question. It refers to kind of a slightly complicated rhetorical flaw that I won't get into right now. But it does raise the question, why on earth do we care? In all of these examples, the meaning is genuinely clear. And usage people and persnickety language people like to say, well, it's about meaning. You have to be clear. And if you're sloppy with your language, then you really run the risk of making yourself unclear. And that's certainly true. However, a lot of these little things that make us so annoyed really, most of the time, don't affect meaning. They very rarely affect meaning. So, as I've been hinting at, not very subtly, throughout this episode, the reason we care is because the audience cares. So how we use the words, how we put them together, which kinds of usage we prefer or do not prefer, really comes from what matters to our audience. What is the voice? What is the tone? What is the collection of phrases and statements that works for them, that's their language? Now, I'm certainly not saying you should be unclear, and I'm actually not saying you should be sloppy, because I think sloppiness is not a good habit in writing or in very much else. But I don't think you have to become a usage obsessive if that's not who your audience is. If you use good, clear, standard, you know, appropriate sentences and nouns and verbs and structures, I think you're going to be fine. So for me, some of these persnickety points are more about play, and they're more about fun, and they're more about bonding with other people who like to get a bit geeky about language than they are about some kind of deep-rooted moral failing, which I think is a bit jerkish behavior a lot of the times. But there are a few errors or kinds of errors that I do think reflect poorly on just about everyone. So slang does not bother me. I like slang. I think slang is interesting. Made-up words don't bother me, although kind of trendy, jargony ones can be a little bit, a little bit boring. But making up words, I think, is really cool and exciting and interesting. And frankly, if your audience uses jargon, then you probably do too. It can be a good shorthand, depending on the situation. Flat-out, simple, unintentional grammatical errors, on the other hand, really do not make you look smart. So if you just really don't have a strong intuitive grasp of the difference between your as a contraction of you are and your, the possessive form that doesn't have an apostrophe in it or an E on the end, I'm afraid that's evidence that your education is really not good. Assuming English is your first language. Now, if English is your second language, I'm a lot more forgiving. You know, ask me sometime how perfect my written Italian is. Answer, it's horrible. So if English is not your first language, then of course you might have issues. If it is your first language and you are struggling with things that kids learn in kind of the third grade, it would really benefit you. I doubt very much that anybody who meets that description is listening to this podcast. It would really benefit you to go back, pick up a good, a good book, a good reference book, and get solid on those things, because truly it makes you look bad. And we see it absolutely every single day, especially in things like, Facebook. The other kind of mistake that makes you look bad in a different way is either obsessing over errors that are not errors. For example, there really is not a rule in English that you can't split an infinitive. Go ahead and split an infinitive if you want to. It doesn't matter. 95% of English speakers are not completely 100% sure what an infinitive even is. It's just not really a rule. The rule against ending a sentence with a preposition, it's not exactly really a rule. It's just a, it's a commonplace, and people with a certain kind of education, it is a shibboleth of a certain kind of education. One of my favorite history teachers did all of his postgraduate work at Oxford, and he never split an infinitive. It was a shibboleth of his kind of education, and that's cool. That's great. He was a wonderful teacher. But I never felt the need to adopt that as my own. It's just not a big deal. Splitting an infinitive, if you don't know, is something like to boldly go where no one has gone before. So to go is an infinitive, and a certain kind of person doesn't like to put anything in between those two. It's not really a rule. So correcting people for rules that are not rules really makes you look like a bozo. It's a technical term there. Another thing that can happen is you overcorrect yourself. And the single word that people are most likely to do this with is whom. So they use whom all the time because somewhere in their head, they sort of think that whom is probably the more grammatically correct word. So whom is just the object and who is the subject. I don't often use whom. I almost never use whom. If I see whom on the blog, I often will quietly change it to who. Whom is one of those words that is gradually getting a little fusty, in my opinion. Now, this is a controversial opinion, and some people who read Copyblogger, perhaps some people who regularly write for Copyblogger, would wildly disagree with me, which is totally okay. But what's not okay is just using whom a lot because it sounds more grammary. When you're a little bit in doubt, go a little less formal than a little more formal. Because if you're a little less formal, you can say, well, it was an informal usage. Whereas if you go more formal sounding and you're wrong, that's just a little bit, that's not good. Another quite common construction you'll see in the overcorrecting, correcting incorrectly, if you will, is a sentence along the lines of, she arrived with he and I. So, no, she really didn't. She arrived with him and me. He and I somehow sound more grammary, right? Sound more correcty, but they're not. He and I are subjects, and she arrived with would call for an object. The takeaway is not necessarily, that it's like fatal to make an error grammatically, although you should probably be familiar with the basic rules. The takeaway here is don't write something because it sounds more proper without checking it. So this episode would not be complete unless I gave you some thoughts on how to look things up if you're not quite sure. I am by absolutely no means perfect in my understanding of the subtleties of the English language. It's quite a complicated language. My favorite resource, bar none, is Paul Bryan's Errors in English. And this is always where I go when I want to check, well, is it hone in or home in? That kind of little small usage question that's a little bit hard to remember. It is a little more on the formal and standard side, which is kind of what you want a reference to be. I really recommend it. I think it's quite good. And he doesn't fall so far on the formal side that, again, you find yourself sounding like a character in a Charles Dickens novel. And I'll wrap this up with a new usage change that was a little bit hard for me to accept. Interestingly, Bill Walsh talks about it in his book and wasn't there yet, but I think we're getting there fairly quickly, which is the word they as a singular non-gendered pronoun. We have used it in spoken English for quite a while. It comes in very handy when you want to use a singular pronoun and you don't know if the person is male or female. It still makes me a little, you know, nervous, I guess would be the way you would say it, in writing. It's not quite standard English yet, but I think it's getting there quite quickly. More and more, you know, a little bit more traditional venues are accepting it because we need it. You know, we need a non-gendered pronoun. It's social reality. It's just, it's the way the world is going. And I'm all for it. So even though it makes me a little personally twitchy, I am working through my twitches. Now, a lot of the times you will just rewrite the sentence so that it's plural, you know, and that works as well. But sometimes you want the strength of the singular. You want a singular example. And so I'm embracing they as a singular pronoun, although not with perfect comfort. And I will end this episode by reiterating the subtitle of Walsh's book, which is, it is fun to talk about, you know, grammatical peeves and usage peeves, and they're entertaining to talk about, and I don't know why. I don't know what makes them so fun, but they really are fun to talk about. But please do not be a jerk about it. It is not presumably your job to go around the internet correcting people's usage. You know, it is a bit much when you're in a conversation with somebody who cannot identify the difference between the two forms of your. However, you know, making ourselves the usage police, it's tedious and it's mean, and we have bigger things to think about. So I would encourage you to be a kind person, be a reasonable person, pick your battles. However, when we get an opportunity to have a good old, you know, chin wag about our favorite twitchy things, let's make space for that because it is quite fun. If you have a favorite peeve, if you have a favorite bad usage or wrong usage that you see and it just makes your eye twitch, let us know about it in the comments. Copyblogger.fm is the place to go. And I will also leave you a couple of links, for example, to Walsh's obituary, which was quite lovingly written in the Washington Post, and to Paul Bryan's wonderful resource, Errors in English. It's so handy. It also comes in handy dandy book form if that's your jam. So that's today. Thank you so much, and I'll catch you next time.